Tonight it is my pleasure to welcome back co-founder of Many Rivers Books and Tea, Stuart Bidnick, Tayu teacher extraordinaire. He has been a Tayu practitioner for just short of a quarter century at this point. We're coming up on that mark. And has been the speaker in this on this stage many, many times before, sometimes delighting, sometimes shocking, always instructing us all. And I'm looking forward to this night's talk. Welcome.
Thank you. And welcome to you all. Lloyd informs me that Absolute Statuary down the street is having a 50% off sale for all statues. So if this version of the Absolute doesn't appeal, then perhaps you can go down the road and get a better deal. This also represents the first time, I think, in Many Rivers history that we've had two talks in one week with the word absolute in the title. So I think for some reason that seems absoluteness seems to be in the air. And the genesis of this talk came about in a study group when one of the participants was asking, why don't we ever talk about the absolute? When we talk about our spiritual practice, when we talk about the Tayu practice and its kind of roots in some fourth way practices, we don't tend to talk about the absolute. We tend to talk about self-observation. We will talk about co-meditation. We will talk about conscious suffering. We will talk about people's practices and what's going on in their practices. But we don't typically talk about the absolute. And so when confronted with the question, repeatedly, I might add, throughout the study group, it seemed to be an interesting theme to explore. Why haven't we talked about it that much in our own work when so many traditions can't shut up about the absolute? You know, there's lots of talk about the absolute. There's lots of talk about ultimate reality. So that's part of what I hope for us to explore this evening. And before we begin, I think it would be useful just to set the energy a little bit with one of the things that we often do talk about, and that's the practice of self-observation. So I'm going to invite you all to spend a few minutes engaged in this practice, and I'll describe it for you in terms of what our particular formulation of this is, and that will just be served to get us into a place where we can start to explore this interesting question. So the way that we practice self-observation is to start by just simply sitting with your back straight in your chair. You can have your feet flat on the floor or not. It's up to you. And allow your gaze to kind of fall at about a 45-degree angle in front of you. You're not staring at anything in particular, but we want to have the eyes open for this practice. When we do this, then imagine a point in the middle of your head that is found by intersecting a line that goes, you know, straight between your eyes and out the back of your head, and a line that goes through the crown of your head and down your spine. So at that point, at that intersection point, imagine that there's a pinhole camera. From this perspective, you'll try to simply observe any thoughts that arise, any feelings that you may be experiencing, or any sensations in the body. So by doing this, and by saying observing it, we simply want to register an awareness, the arising of something, much like you'd see this teapot on the table. If you find yourself getting caught in any of these events, like thinking about something or trying to describe it to yourself, you just gently remind yourself to bring your attention back to this observer perspective. The key thing with the observer, and this is something that we'll get into a little bit later as we explore this question of the absolute, is that the observer is silent. So if what you are experiencing internally is talking and characterizing and analyzing, that's not the observer. That's simply something to observe. It's simply more phenomenon to observe. And I also want to invite you, while you do this practice for a few minutes, to if you happen to find that there's any sort of space between two thoughts that may arise, or between a feeling or a sensation and your awareness of it, if there's even a moment or a pause or a gap, put some attention on that as well. Put some attention on the background within which all of these events, like thoughts and feelings and sensations, arise. So let's do that for a few minutes. As I said, keep the eyes open. The observer doesn't speak. And begin. Stop. Any questions or comments about the self-observation practice before we jump into the absolute? So I started the discussion by describing why it is that in our study groups we haven't talked about the absolute, or at least I alluded to that question, and I want to elaborate on that some more, because the absolute in the Tayu tradition is certainly not something that's ignored or doesn't exist or isn't considered, but it's not something we talk about a lot, because really, what is there to say? The problem is that anything we say in connection with the absolute seems to be lacking. I recall a few weeks ago, Jim was giving a talk on silence, and he brought out a quote from Pseudo-Dionysus, and the quote was beautiful, and I won't repeat it all now, but basically the essence of it was that, you know, anything you say, anything you think about, anything you try to relate to or grab onto is not it, is not this ultimate reality. And I even hate saying that, because the minute I even say the term ultimate reality, I'm already off the mark there. And yet, in a lot of popular spiritual movements and spiritual presentations today, there's lots of talk about the ultimate reality. There's lots of talk about everything is consciousness. There's lots of talk about non-duality. And the problem that I have with that, and part of the reason for this talk, is that talking in those terms begins to just create this kind of accretion at a conceptual layer that becomes more of a imposition or a separation from that very thing that people are pretending to talk about. The other thing that comes up in relation to this topic is that it's hard to talk about the absolute without a strong foundation of spiritual practice, because when you read it in a book, or you hear someone talking about it and you hear the words and you try to relate to the what does this mean, you know, what is my biggest sense of reality, what is my biggest sense of existence, it's hard to not approach that the way we approach trying to understand anything with our conventional analytic abilities, whether verbal or mathematically or symbolically or visually. And yet, when one engages in spiritual practice for an extended period of time, and I'm talking about years or decades, there is an accumulation of a certain something. We often refer to that in our tradition as presence, that provides a foundation within which perhaps the notion or the idea of the absolute may have some more of a sense of roots. And so I guess I would answer partly the question of why we don't talk about the absolute so much, is that it's a little pretentious to do that, for one thing. For another, it's not particularly useful for people at a certain level of practice, when what's really necessary is the creation at an energetic level of this very sense of presence that I was describing. So to throw out ultimate concepts, concepts about God, even to some extent concepts about love, in the without the foundation of a solid, thriving spiritual practice, almost necessarily requires that those concepts descend to the level of ordinary thinking or ordinary egoic level thinking. And unfortunately, when that happens, people can latch on to a new set of concepts, you know, whether it's the latest non-dualist presentation, and our minds are so anxious to find the answer and the right answer and to have the inside track that that tends to then get people stuck in a very subtle ways, because at a intellectual level they have the right answer to everything. Everything's consciousness. You know, don't tell me anything. Everything's consciousness. There is no separation. Everything is God, so nothing can be wrong. Everything is one. And in one sense that's true, in another sense that's completely a lie. And when we engage with those kinds of concepts without the requisite practice, without the requisite spiritual humility that is cultivated with the cultivation of presence, then inevitably that stuff just becomes shit. It just becomes more food for our egoic structures to, in extremely and progressively subtler and subtler ways, tell us how smart we are and allow us to maintain a certain veil of superiority because we have the right answer. So that's part of the reason we don't talk about these things so much. It's not that there's no place for the absolute in our spiritual tradition. It's that the place is so large that to talk about it in the wrong way, to talk about it without having set the appropriate conditions for having the discussion, is a disservice to the subject matter. So even now, I'm somewhat reluctant to give a talk on the absolute. So I had to couch it in a title that was catchy and somewhat irreverent, which is effing the ineffable. And so, what does that mean? What do I mean by those words? You know, merging with the absolute, effing the ineffable. So here's a couple of things. One is that ineffability is often used to describe ultimacy, because ineffability is means that which cannot be expressed or unexpressible. So if I say the absolute is ineffable, I'm saying it can't be expressed. If I say it's effable, I'm saying, well, I can express it. I can somehow meaningfully convey something in words, symbols, music, whatever, to you that conveys some experience of absolute reality. And even there, I'm getting into trouble by using the word experience in connection with absolute. So, effing the ineffable, what does that mean? What does it mean to express that which cannot be expressed? What does that mean? What does it mean to actually convey in some form that which, by its very, by definition, cannot be conveyed? It seems kind of paradoxical, and it's a challenging question. I don't know if I have the answer. Maybe you all can help me with this tonight. But I will claim that there may be a way to approach the topic. There may be a way, if not perfectly, to begin to eff the ineffable by, in some way or some form. And perhaps we can explore that as we continue on. Yeah.
Do you think there are degrees of ineffability? It's almost that, like asking, are there degrees of infinity when you have a reference point and what we said?
That's an interesting question. I'm, sure. There's degrees of ineffability. They usually are captured by the term the unknown and the unknowable. So there can be relative unknowing, that is just simply a limitation of our ability. Mm-hmm. And then there's the unknowable, which is by its very nature, we can't know.
Yeah, that takes me back to Castaneda, who said there were three areas, the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. But you're kind of on the same track as I was, though. And I'm wondering if, you know, when I think about what the ineffable is just probably relative to me. And something can seem utterly transcendent to me, and it might be utterly pedestrian to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's certainly been my experience in spiritual practice that there are certain things that I haven't a clue about early, you know, at a certain stage of practice that I start to have a clue about at another stage. Very subtle shifts in myself, subtle shifts of energy. But I would still say that that's a relative understanding, and that there, when we talk about the absolute, we're talking about something that transcends even that kind of scale. So in that sense, if you're talking about the transcendent, I'd say there is no scale. It's simply a... can't be talked about. James, did you have a question?
Yeah. What's the point?
That's a good question. What is the point? What's the point about talking about this, or what's the point about even looking at this question?
Yeah.
Well, that is a good question. What?
What productive purpose would it have for me to try to F the inevitable?
So I think that gets to me into the question of what it might mean, what I might mean by saying F in the ineffable. Hmm. And so then let me describe that and then see if there's, then I'll claim a point in there, which is that I don't think there's anything you can say. I don't think there's anything you can describe to me that would F the ineffable. But I do believe there's something that you can do that would F the ineffable. And that doing, or maybe better said, that undoing, represents an ongoing process of release or surrender of that within yourself that keeps you in separation from others. And so, as a working concept, I will say, practically speaking, that would constitute effing the ineffable. And there you don't have to articulate anything. Your life becomes an expression. And there's no question of whether you get there ultimately or not, but you are engaged in an ongoing practice and an ongoing revelation in your life to yourself and to others of supreme letting go. And that letting go continues. And you continue to let go as much as you possibly can with everything that comes up. And then I'd say that maybe you're starting to effing get it.
You used the term ongoing revelation, didn't you just?
Mm-hmm, I did.
Yeah.
I'm guilty of time.
It seems to me that effing the ineffable is what life is. That life is that ongoing revelation of what cannot be spoken. But life is that speaking. So just speak.
mm-hmm. I have no problem with that formulation. The only edge I would add to, which I was adding, you know, in James's question, is that for us as practitioners, for us as engaged in a spiritual path, using that concept for me needs to have some practicality. I don't want this just to be a poetic statement. And the practicality is, what do I do? You know, what is my guidance? How do I know if I'm on the track of this ongoing expression? How do I know if I am participating in that conversation, if, as you might be like to say? How do I know if I am effing the ineffable? And that to me conveys a certain kind of way of being, not the what I do and not the words that I use, but the how I am engaged in this unfolding, ongoing flux of life. How do I mix with that? And the mixing with that and the dancing with that is where I want to approach this whole question of effing the ineffable. Because we are in form. We are effable in the sense that we are in a realm where there's differentiation, there's distinction, and yet that's all happening in a context that seems to be beyond that. Maybe. That's an assertion.
The word drama is coming to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow it just feels like what you're describing is the challenge. Is the challenge of the moment.
Mm-hmm. And, sure, it's a challenge. It's a challenge of every moment. And that the question for us in that challenge is, how do we rise to that challenge? How do we...
But is it possible... Okay, is it possible to be not effing? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a point of reference thing. When it depends on where you're looking at it.
Yeah, it certainly depends on how you where you're drawing your distinctions of self, and that's itself a complex question, because sure we can say I might even call this a glib spiritual perspective, that everyone is saved, everyone is whether someone is awake or not in some sense. They're part of the divine movement. How could you not be? That just by definition. But that definition is sort of like, as our speaker on Monday night was saying, is sort of reductionistic. It's sort of, there's no great knowing in that. There's great ignorance in that statement, because it ignores the reality of our condition. It ignores the reality of our experience as embodied persons. And so to make a broad statement like we can't do, we can't not help being part of the absolute, we can't help not being merged with the absolute, is a useless statement, even if it is logically true. Because it doesn't, because it's a generality to the degree of, it's about as interesting as me getting up here and writing the one number one up here, and kind of going, oh, look at that. Sure, I can do it, but that abstraction is so useless to anybody, unless you want to do something with that. There's no point in that. There would be no point in that. That would be sort of self-indulgent. So the more interesting question to me is not the question or the statement or the assertion of that we are all one, we are all, reflections in God's mind, but what is the reality of our individual embodied personal experience with respect to this transcendent reality that we are immersed in? And how does one participate actively and consciously within that ongoing dance? That, to me, is the interesting question, because then effing the ineffable actually has some music associated with it, as opposed to some sort of dead symbol that's drawn on a whiteboard. Nancy, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was kind of interested. I happened to be reading Franklin Merrill Wolfe today, a copy of the book, and he talks about beyond the stage of thought, there's knowing by identity.
Mm-hmm.
And he is trying to speak about an unspeakable experience he had. And so I don't really know, I can't know what his experience really is. So to me, what I think fits with what you're saying is that our own experience is really kind of a foundation or a basis for how we understand things. And that may change over time. Hopefully it will change or develop over time. But anyway, but I was interested in this idea that certainly thinking has its limitations, and a person who thinks a lot will run up against that. Some people do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And this possibility of knowing something directly by participating in it or being in it, I find an interesting idea. I'm left with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you get from here to there? Or what could happen
right.
to enable that?
Right. Well, I think that's a great question, and there's a couple of things that come up for me with response to that. One is that first, there's nothing wrong with thinking. You know, I guess by definition, by my to put my glib spiritual definition hat on, it's part of the absolute. So thinking has to be conditioned by divinity. There's nothing wrong with thinking in that sense, but the appropriate use of thinking is the probably the more interesting practical question. And I find thoughts, particularly thoughts about spiritual work and practice, are best treated like listening to music, which is music has the power of causing to arise in us a kind of a unified experience that allows us to, as a whole, move into a different place. Concepts can allow us to do that as well in certain conditions. However, if we identify with the intellectual ideas, and by identifying, I mean if we create kind of an emotional identity around assertions of truth values of those things, and keep going back to it, we kind of become like the, you know, people we see with their iPods stuck in their heads all the time, you know, just kind of tripping out to music and not paying attention to what's going on around them. And so in that sense, that identification with the thought structures is a problem. So from a practical point of view, when you ask about how do I make this transition, probably the hardest thing, and the thing that literally takes years and years and years of assiduous practice, and the thing that occurs with the cultivation of this presence of being that I was describing, is the slipping away or the weakening of that compulsive habit to identify with the contents of our conscious experience, be they thoughts, feelings, sensations in the body. And that is probably the hardest single task I find in spiritual practice. Because people come to practice with a whole set of problems that they want to fix. People live their lives with a whole set of problems that they're all kind of struggle with. We're trying to be happy. We're trying to find meaning. Compulsively, the human condition is to reach outward to grab something that will complete us. And all of that is a function of this process of identification. Identification is identity making. We create these identities. We create big identities. We create small identities that have these clusters of thoughts and feelings and sensations that are constantly ruling our lives. That's our condition. And so to make that gap between thinking mind, feeling mind, or sensation mind requires a recognition of and an intentional shifting of that habit of identification. When we make that shift, even a little bit, and you know, everything happens in degrees in a lifetime of practice, but as we make that shift, then there's some actual juice behind the words I was saying to James about what it means to let go of everything. Because ceasing to identify, being willing to not identify, to hold the contents of our internal experiences, no matter how agonizing they may be or how tempting they may be, you know, they can be good and bad, but if we can just hold them and not go into them the way that we chronically do under normal conditions, then in that way, something different might, there might be room for something different, and then there might be room for a kind of a spaciousness wherein the question of the absolute might have a different sense of meaning. Yes, sir.
To be less wordy, return to basics. You reminded me of the effort thing. When I was a freshman at NYU, we had to take Philosophy 101. The major part of the semester was on proving the existence of God. And the very elementary example that was given was the chair you're sitting on. We could use our ordinary functions, like our minds, sensing. We can, everyone here would agree that somebody made that chair. Okay. We might get some butthead that would want to say, you know, why should we bother? But we all agree somebody made that chair. Now, when you're a freshman, when you hear the whole thing, it's really awe-striking. You know, wow. So if we take that same functioning and look at the entire creation, we could say, did somebody make this thing? Now it's more of a stretch there, because the chair we can prove is a verifiable act. We want to trace it down. And we look underneath, we see it's made in China. We go to China, we find Ho Ming, he made it. He said, yeah, I made it there. And then we prove it. But the, like, with the, what's his name?
Carl,
right. Carl, when he said the relative degrees of an absolute concept, when we get into the whole creation, not just a tree or an animal or ourselves, but the entire creation, as far as you could go with it, and as small as you could go with it, there was somebody, maybe in China, but the cosmic China, that made all of this. Now, I know this is, you know, it's a philosophy class, so it was, you know, the parameters are different here. So, thinking, very, you know, like when you're 18-year-old or 19-year-old doing that, it seems very poor, you know, like, oh, of course, there's got to be, there's an existence. And like what Nancy was saying about the idea of experience, to be able to understand, you know, to see that and not to take it for granted, because I feel the absolute is taken for granted. That's the problem.
All right, that's why you brought it up in the our study group.
Yeah, the whole thing.
Right.
And what Nancy said is actually the answer, because there's many people crawling all over the big mud ball, but there are few, so like my belief says, there's a few people that have an experience that's been given to them by the person who made the creation, and it gives you more energy. So when you think about it, or whatever you want to call that, the meaning of the absolute and why we have to put up with all the crap we put up with makes sense. You need the experience. You need the personal experience to appreciate that very basic understanding.
Okay.
You know, Philosophy 101 says that God exists. Well, whoever created it, we call the absolute. How do you feel about something simplistic like that?
Oh, I'm going to say thank you for... see, I don't think it's not so easy to be unworthy about this topic, which is paradoxical since it's ineffable, but it seems like...
Absolutely.
Maybe we approach it with an infinite number of words. But I have a couple of responses to your question. One, I'll start with a sort of a philosophical one, and then I'll give you a personal one. The philosophical one is that the way you describe that to me still feels to me like there's this implicit in the whole construct is a separation or a sense of separation of you looking out and trying to contain this big universe to find a point for your existence. And so the personal story I was reminded of, and some of you have heard this before, and if you have, I apologize, but James reminded me of it earlier today because we were kind of sharing stories about kind of early spiritual experiences. And mine was that when I was in second or third grade, I had been studying astronomy really, you know, diligently because I had had an ego-deflating experience in which I did badly on an astronomy test. I insisted on becoming the expert in astronomy, which actually launched my scientific career, such as it was, that ego-deflation moment. But
helps.
Yeah, it helps. But the what I found myself as on the street one day in front of our house, and I was starting to go through my mind this sort of the levels of cosmic reality, and I could understand the Earth as a planet, I could understand the Moon as a satellite around the Earth, and I could understand the Sun, I could understand the solar system, I could understand the galaxy, and I had this big picture of the universe. And then for some reason I asked myself, why do I have self-consciousness? And it's like a truck hitting a wall for me, because I couldn't get my mind around it the way that I was used to getting my mind around these other concepts. You know, I couldn't hold the immediate reality of my individuated self experience in that moment. I tried to, and it would slip away. I tried to grab it, and it would slip away. And you know, I was a kid, so pretty soon other stuff distracted me, and away it went. But that experience stayed with me because it taught me a couple of things early on that became kind of a seed for later spiritual practice. And one was that there was a distinction between that vital core of my being and the way I conventionally understood everything else. So that has given me a healthy skepticism for any set of words that pretends to describe ultimate reality, because any compactification or any sort of presentation that is made and then asserted to be somehow true, I already have this direct datum crystallized within me at an early age. That's simply not the case. The other thing that it taught me that became more important, or has become an ongoing theme in my own practice, is that the real mystery is in that direction. The real mystery is that depth of self experience, that self nature, that I couldn't possibly touch. It was like a flame. It wasn't hot exactly, but it was like a flame that every time I tried to grab, I couldn't get any purchase on it, and yet it never went out. And there it was. And so I've come to see that going in that direction is ultimately the best direction to move in order to answer the question of what does it mean to merge with the absolute, rather than trying to go in the direction that I felt that you were describing, which was to try to find some way to encompass everything in some way to provide a sense of meaning. The sense of meaning for me was already found in that early shock, which was the shock of confrontation with something real that defied all categories.
Well, I don't mean it as complex. I really meant that it being simple in the sense that it's here. I mean, yourself, we're all here. Is that too basic to say that there's the creator that made it all, and that there's some reason for us existing rather than just playing with ourselves?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't find that a particularly critical question in one sense, because I don't know I don't know what would be different about whether there's a creator or not a creator. I don't know what that means. And I don't want to make this into a philosophical discussion, because it doesn't have to mean anything. Okay, so merging with the absolute doesn't mean anything in one sense.
It could just, then you're saying it could be just an accident.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. I'm actually saying it's not an accident, and it is an accident. So what? Okay. That's what I'm saying. And I'm saying it's not a... the question for me doesn't have meaning, or it's not at stake for providing meaning in why to engage in spiritual practice. Yeah, I guess you could say it doesn't settle anything, or it doesn't change anything, because there's no juice in it for me. Maybe there's juice in it for you, but
I the question.
Yeah, so for me, for me, there's.
It seemed like everybody was struggling with the idea that it can't be known, and it's don't try, and all this. And I just thought of that from my past,
mm-hmm.
that when we were 18, 19 years old, it seemed like everyone in the class seemed to accept it.
But they can't. It can't be known.
Yeah, somebody made all this. So
lots of people accept
not necessarily the sun and the moon, but this experience you had, and this bookstore, and our reason why we came here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just wouldn't the fact the place has got people in here, they have an interest in knowing what is this? I mean, it's a very vain and arrogant topic, you know, for us humble humans to take on, you know.
Indeed, yes, that's humble humans.
I came here thinking that this was gonna, wow, what a topic.
This is like bait and switch, isn't it?
I told my boss that I can't miss this.
You can't miss this. You know, this guy's gonna talk about the absolute, and here I am saying no.
Yeah, you know,
I can't talk about it. Sorry.
Yeah.
So are you gonna tell us how to find the Made in China sign? On the underside of our
cosmic.
That's right.
The cosmic.
You know, I looked so deep. Was there a question over here?
Yeah, I guess I have a comment and a question. You know, a lot of this can... it doesn't really hold my interest anymore. A lot of it. And I can see how it's... You could flip around in a lot of abstractions and think that it's really not a bunch of just abstractions flipping around, which are endless. I really liked the direction that you went in just a minute ago about your sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me the distinction between whatever, you know, the ineffable is and yourself is really the key. In other words, you're not going to know, you're not going to be able to think your way into the ineffable. But you can know yourself, and there is a palpable sense of self. So the thing that is perplexing for me is, out of all the practices, there seems to be a multitude of practices, why not look at this sense of self, which, of course, if you're sensitive to it at all, it encompasses a sense of, or includes a sense of separation, includes a sense of free will, and includes a sense of I exist here but not there. Yeah, whatever it is that you can define yourself as,
mm-hmm.
you can logically understand that is, in fact, the separation that you so much want to get away from. Why isn't that a central practice in the Toyu tradition or any other tradition, since it's so logical? It's such a logical approach.
Right. Well, so first I would say I tend to agree with you as far as the questions of the ineffable or the absolute are of less interest as sort of conceptual games. They can be useful as sort of tools, and when they're useful tools to get people to look at things in different categories, I think they can be very effective. But what you're asking about, I would say my experience is that practice does come up in various forms in different spiritual traditions. The way that it comes up in our Tayu practice is through the practice of self-observation. And the practice of self-observation is intended to be first it starts as a tool or a practice, in a sense of that, because when one is starting to do anything, it's like there's a form one adopts for purposes of trying to narrow or deepen into a particular practice. But as time goes on, the form becomes less important. So the form I described earlier is less important. But what is more important is that it's a vehicle for learning to disidentify. And it's a vehicle for doing exactly what you were describing, which is the letting go of the conventional answers to what am I? Because our normal psychological state is one in which we are identified, heavily identified, at many, many levels, some of which we can see kind of obviously, and many that we actually are incredibly subtle, that are combinations of emotional states and intellectual states and projections about what we are, what we should be, what other people are, what their relationship to us are, and even identifications with how we should feel in our bodies, you know, how we should respond to particular risings of particular sensations in our bodies. All of that stuff is the false answers to that inquiry about what is the nature of this self.
And they stem from egoic conceptions.
They, in a sense,
when you're asking these questions,
yeah,
you're trying to satisfy an egoic.
What I would say is that the answer is more of a conventional answer is sort of a manifestation of the ego, of the functioning of the ego. The asking the question, or the looking, or the observing, that quality of awareness that is able to hold in silence the knowingness, whatever that means, not conceptually, but the knowingness of the arising of a thought or the arising of a feeling across the field of our consciousness and our body, that awareness, there's something there. There's something fundamental there that as we deepen in this practice of self-observation in its very many forms, and there's lots of different forms it takes that we use, but as one deepens in this overall practice, one's identity effectively shifts from the content to that aspect that's actually able to hold in silence the awareness of the content. And when that shift begins to take place, we find a deeper answer to that fundamental inquiry of what is the nature of ourself. And so the practice is there. And the practice does exist in other traditions. The traditional, I think, description of it in the Hindu tradition or various forms of Hindu tradition is the neti neti, which is not this, not this, which is an ongoing practice of inquiry. What distinguishes, I don't know if it distinguishes it, but was characteristic of the of our Tayu practice and the fourth way practices that have influenced us is that there's a particular model that's used, not in an absolute sense, but just in a sense of efficacy, which is to divide our organism into the thinking part, the feeling part, and the sensing part, and to look at the substructure of our identifications in terms of that model. Now that sounds very heady and intellectual, and the way I'm describing it, but the reality of the practice is instantaneous and dramatic at a confrontational level, because when we confront identification, when we confront that aspect in ourselves that is holding on to a identity that is not absolute, usually there's some resistance, and usually there's some friction. And I can't write down a practice in a book to describe the exquisite both agony and joy associated with working in a spiritual community with practitioners wherein the very nature of the engagement causes spontaneously to arise conditions that cause confrontation with those identities that we're clinging with. And in that arising, there is great energy released, sometimes painful, sometimes ecstatic, but that intensity is what decrystallizes the matrix of identifications that we hold in our organism. And it's through that intensity that we're able to ultimately surrender or let go of those kind of clinging aspects of ourselves, such that what's left is something deeper, something more fundamental that gets to the, again, to the question. I don't know that there's ever an answer to that question, in the sense that we talk about self-realization in spiritual contexts, but in another sense, the ultimate nature of self is this mystery too. And I kind of like it as a mystery in that I, you know, because it frees me from having to figure it out, but it does give me the freedom to deepen into the mystery. And in that sense, again, what I've just been describing, I would classify under the bracket of merging with the absolute.
Would I be happier if I didn't think about all this stuff?
Yes. But.
Yes, but.
The but is that I say that in a sort of you would be happier if you didn't think about all that stuff, but if you don't think about this stuff, but think about all the other stuff you're used to thinking, then you won't be happier.
I see.
So there's no escape from that one.
Yeah.
Do you have a question? Hey. No. All right.
Yes, let's say the people that believe in this, what you call the absolute. What's the idea of the judgment that this that we're all, everyone's room is going to be dead someday, and we're going to fly off to this judgment table?
No, actually, we're going to descend. I have the truth on my shirt right here. Right. We're going to descend. And we're going to come before the god Osiris and Maat, the goddess of truth, and we're going to take our heart and weigh it on a scale against the feather of truth.
Right.
And if our heart is too heavy and it kind of makes the scale go like this and the feather flies off, then there's this beast that has a hippopotamus body and an alligator head that will devour our soul.
That's not a very good beast.
That's what's going to happen.
Well, that's what I meant. I didn't know if you believe it. That's like
a pretty good beast.
I thought I was the only one.
That happened to me once, actually.
It's happened to me many times, to tell you the truth.
Well, I feel better now. I'm not the only one.
Yeah. Actually, I should mention that it's pertinent here that the reason I wore this shirt, which was a gift to me recently from two of our students, that this is the Eye of Horus, or the, I think it's Wedged Eye in my broken Egyptian. And at least one fourth wave practitioner who was a student of Oraj, who was probably more a student of Oraj than a student of Gurdjieff by any stretch of the imagination, but he actually, his name was C. Daly King, and he, you know, captured and actually preserved Oraj's original understanding of the fourth way work. But King also wrote a book towards the end of his life, and apparently he was fancied himself an Egyptologist, and his claim was that in the Egyptian spiritual tradition that there was a form of self-observation as it's understood in the fourth way tradition, which he called scrutinizing. And the esoteric symbol for scrutinizing was the Eye of Horus. So this Eye of Horus, the Wedged Eye, which was used on amulets, used all over the place on in all sorts of religious depictions, is intended, in his mind anyway, to represent the process by which we have this eye, as it were, that is able to behold the functioning of our organism. objectively. So I thought it was appropriate for this particular talk to wear that. The rest of this is a bunch of bullshit about kings and how great they were and how glorious they were, but at least the eye is still there.
I thought it was because the t-shirt matches your shoes so perfectly.
Oh. That would be due to my fashion eye.
Is there anything about you can tell us about the meaning of the iconography itself? I mean, the eye part is pretty obvious, but then it's got these three, and I'm wondering if there's significance to the three.
I wish I could I could riff on that for a while, but I always thought it was mascara.
Yeah.
Yeah, could have been both. I mean, for the Egyptians, mascara was pretty important. Probably ground lapis lazuli or something like that. Yes.
So you talked about in the little description of tonight about what would a person have to give up to merge with the
right.
What can you answer? You talk about your topic or your question?
Sure. Yeah, thank you for bringing me back to that, because eventually I wanted to get back to that. That really goes back to the question that we started with about what's the point. And when we look at this topic of merging with the absolute, that's a pretty big topic. And when a lot of people want to create definitions about what that means and have a nice pat formula that, I understand reality, that formulation will keep us in great separation of that. But what I guess I would advocate and what our practice entails is ultimately to merge with the absolute means to give up everything, to be willing to give up everything. I mean, ultimately, we are going to give up everything in that these bodies we find ourselves in don't last forever. So we know that there's in store for us a great laboratory of spiritual experimentation called death, in which we get to discover what exactly the process entails. So prior to that, however, when in the discussion...
After we expire?
Well, I would say while you're expiring, okay. the experiment begins. Whether it ends at death or beyond death is a function of the beliefs you take into the process. But I don't need to speak to that because you get to do the experiment. And so anything I say on this subject would be presumptuous. I have my ideas, but they're my ideas. And I like my ideas. They're nice, but they're kind of like the tune, my music list on my iPod, if I had an iPod, which is, I like to play those things, but so what? You get to do the experiment, and that's what really counts. So, to your question of what do you give up, in approaching that kind of ultimate experiment, we can give up, in the very process that we were talking about, that you were describing, the false answers to the question of what is this nature of self? And if we are willing to drop those down, and I don't mean this in any sort of self-violence sense or anything, but simply the willingness to hold those things as not who we really are, but to treat them more like I was describing my music list. These are particular collections of songs that I happen to have programmed into this organism, but that doesn't mean that that's who I am. So if we can continue to return to, putting the iPod down I don't want to use neti neti because people may have different understandings of that, because that almost is still at an intellectual level, and I'm talking about something that's goes far deeper than that. I don't want the argument, because some people would, ultimately, neti neti is probably, as a practice, much deeper than that.
It's a way of discarding.
Yeah. But when I say discarding things, I don't just mean, me discarding the idea that I like bacon, or something like that. I mean, discarding the idea that I'm telling the truth when I'm lying, or that I'm not wanting something, you know, in a relationship that I'm not willing to admit to myself, or that I'm not acting selfishly when I have this idea of myself that I'm a generous person. And those kinds of things have a lot more stickiness to them. And so those are the sorts of things that, as we engage, particularly in that process of friction I was describing that constitutes a spiritual community, as you lay those things down, I would say that that's, that demonstrates a willingness to give up everything. And my claim is, I tend to observe that it's not a common thing for people to be willing to give up that much. It's not a common thing for people to be willing to give up their egoic structure. It is fairly uncommon, in fact. And so even though the ranks of the shelves of this bookstore are filled with books, and the ranks of the spiritual communities in Northern California are filled with earnest practitioners, I still would claim to you and ask you to challenge in yourselves that it's a fairly rare thing for people to truly be willing to give up their egoic structure. Most people don't even know what that means. Most people say, sure I am. Sure, I'm spiritual. You know, everything's God. I'm willing to give up.
Starbucks.
Yeah. Actually, E.J. Gold, who is a influence on our tradition, had in one of his American Books of the Dead, one of the earlier versions, a thing he called the Phenomenal Fact Quiz, which read like this: all phenomena is illusion except, and then there was a list of like coffee, television, sex. So you could take your own Phenomenal Fact Quiz. So, but we find that we saw, you know, even people who have the pretensions of being very spiritual, often when confronted with actually the reality of what it means to give up their identification with their egoic structure, run screaming. You know, all of a sudden, you know.
Well, it's the same thing. What's the point?
Well, that's a good question. And what is the point? Yeah, maybe there is no point to giving it up. The point, I would say, is that that most people who live a life actively identified with their egoic structure don't have a genuine sense of peace or happiness. For many people, in fact, the majority of people in the world, the dissatisfaction is not sufficiently agonizing to induce a need for an alternative. And again, so people who are comfortable in their egoic structures have no real requirement for spiritual practice. And don't get me wrong, I do not believe that spiritual practice is necessary for everybody. I do not sit in judgment of people who are not engaged in a genuine spiritual practice. My belief, and again, you know, my particular piece of music on my music list is that the universe or great nature has uses for everybody in various forms, and that genuine spiritual practice is an option that's available to us as human beings, but that it is not a requirement or a necessity, but it is something that is available. So for people who find themselves in the normal state of identification with an egoic structure that are in agony because of that, because it doesn't satisfy, and I don't necessarily mean pain, absolute pain, but sort of just feel unsettled because of that. For those people, there is a point. And the point is, maybe there's an alternative. They don't know if there's an alternative, but the agony has to be sufficient that the alternative is, the willingness to risk something for the alternative is sufficiently high that they engage in the possibility that there is an alternative.
So it's not for everyone.
It's not for everyone.
Do you know the Anais Nin quote, that the time came when the pain, when the risk of staying tight in the bud was more painful than the risk of blossoming?
That's nice. I like that. Thank you.
Yeah.
One of my friends asked me what it's like to be spiritual. I said, well, look at it this way. We're all spirits. We're having experiences living as human beings. So you're living a spiritual life, whether you know it or not. You are a spirit.
What does that mean? I am a spirit.
It means that whatever your experience of life are, they're yours. But you are a spirit. We know the human body is going to die.
Right.
If we can accept that and live with that, and live life joyfully, then we're living a spiritual life. We don't have to know all the answers.
Yeah, but so there's something in me that is a spirit that will exist beyond this physical body.
Yeah. There is something beyond the physical body.
And will I be aware of that after I die?
Probably. Hopefully we can learn it before we die.
So what is it that...
I don't know.
Well, so let me address that question, because I agree with what Billy Sue is saying, but I put my agreement as one of my items in my music list. So practically speaking, as far as what drives me to be committed to spiritual practice, what the end of that is, what the meaning of that is, what the purpose of that is, has nothing to do with whether I believe or not that there is going to be some conscious awareness of myself after I die. Because I'm smart enough that I can think of all sorts of alternatives where, you know, I lose every sense of what I call my identity now, and even though that sort of quality of awareness I was talking about may persist, maybe I have no sense or memory of anything else. Or maybe there is a memory. I don't know. But that doesn't make a difference, because in the end, the question is, are you comfortable enmeshed in the egoic structure you find yourself in or not? And can you live your life comfortably in that way? If you can't, then there's an alternative experiment, at least, or an alternative exploration that's available to see what might be an alternative to that mode of existence. From that place, I would claim, you would have the sufficient intuitive tools to address questions about your own transpersonal existence without me telling you anything. But there's no point in talking about that, because I can't prove any of that to you, one way or the other.
Right. You're very smart, man. I'm not sure I'm keeping up with you entirely. And I'm not like a, you know, petri dish materialist. You know, there's perhaps something abstract that, you know, some animating energy or something. But isn't the idea of spirit or a transcendent consciousness, isn't that like the ultimate ego assertion?
I think that there's a good argument to be made for that. Yeah. Sure. I mean,
the idea that I'm going to have to be, that something mysterious and magical in me is going to be aware beyond this physical body.
Right.
I mean, that sounds like a pretty strong ego identification.
I also agree with that. That's another of my pieces of music on my internal iPod.
My iPod's better than yours.
Yeah. How big's your disc? But the.
I'm just kidding.
But yeah, my point is that I can agree 100% with you and agree 100% with Billy Sue, because these ideas are second to the point. Yeah, sure. What you're saying is that is a egoistic assertion, and probably one of the biggest ones, and many people cling to that because they're terrified at the prospect of their own non-existence.
And then it's not pointless, because it affects how you're conducting yourself now.
Yes, in that sense. I mean, but as part of spiritual practice,
right.
As part of spiritual work, one of the things it's useful to give up, at least for part of the process, is the idea that we're going to continue beyond this moment. You know, and if we're willing to give that up, if we're willing to truly die in this moment completely, then we also are willing for other possibilities to arise in this moment completely as well. And so, you know, I find both concepts useful. They're useful for different purposes. If someone is locked in fear because they have this chronic, identification with their death, and they orient their lives compulsively around avoiding death, like most Americans do, then the idea that you're a spirit and your existence will be here beyond the death of your physical body can be a useful device to at least loosen some of that compulsive activity.
My old man is contemplating his death because it might be coming pretty soon, and he's done the opposite, which I think is remarkable. I think he's a good guy. And most of his life he'd probably be what you call a non-practicing Christian or something like that. And now he's decided that he's not. He's decided that he's atheist, and I think that's awfully brave. In the face of his death, he's decided, I don't want that comfort. I think it's nonsense.
And I actually think that's kind of smart. You know, my father was, he died 2 years ago, and he was, paradoxically, I would call him one of my strongest spiritual influences, and yet he felt betrayed by organized religion all his life, and ultimately affected a more materialistic viewpoint, and didn't have the sense that there was much, that there would be survival after death, or he wasn't as concerned about that, or didn't think about that, as far as I know. And yet, his death was one of the most beautiful, poignant spiritual moments for our family that I think we've had together. And it was because we were present with him in love, in that immediacy. And the thought of what happened afterward was absolutely unimportant. We were the caregivers for that 2 week period. You know, we cleaned him, we bathed him, we fed him while he could eat. You know, I would look into his eyes when he couldn't speak. And the issue of what he believed or not was completely beside the point. We were acting in the moment as the moment required us to act. And that, to me, is the quintessential aspect of being spiritual. These ideas of what we believe, you know, I don't care about the ideas, really. This is, to quote our friend Lee Lozowick, a well-known spiritual teacher who has his center in Prescott, Arizona, of all places. It doesn't matter what people say about their spiritual practice. What matters is how do they act. You know, how do they behave? How do they treat other people? And my claim, from a practical point of view, of spiritual practice is that doing the stuff we're describing about letting go, doing the stuff we're describing about self-observation, doing the stuff, you know, all this confrontational work to sort of melt down the crystallization of the egoic structure and to allow ourselves to form something else in out of the substance of presence, all of that stuff isn't worth a hill of beans if it isn't reflected in the way that someone who engages in that process ultimately acts in the world with other people. And so my measure of spiritual progress is how does someone act. It's not what someone how clever they are in terms of talking about
the absolute.
It's about, you know, how do they handle moments like that? How do they handle the moment, you know, like the death of a parent? What do they do? The death of a loved one. How do they handle the death of a relationship? How do they handle people on the street, you know, how do they handle their lives in general? You know, are they identified? Are they, or is there something else going on there?
Well, I'd like to qualify some of the things that I said. Last week, I was watching a program while I was working on the computer, and a woman came in and she was working with this young girl who was involved in the death of a young boy with prescription drugs, and the girl wouldn't talk. Anyhow, this woman comes in and she says, "You need to talk now. If you don't, you're going to lock the 16-year-old in a loop." And I said, "That's it. That's it. Somewhere in all this, we have a bit of ourself that's locked in a loop of ourself." So self-observation gives us an opportunity to meet that self at the age we are now. I'm 82. So I'm meeting a lot of little selves that have been locked in my psyche for a long time. It's not that they're right or they're wrong, but they injure us and we're frightened of them. So we find ways to get along without seeing them.
Yeah.
So meditation leads you to that point where you can observe things without making them wrong, without trying to change you, but just meet them and ask them to join you now. clarify anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That's a nice way of formulating the practice. Yeah. And to the question of, again, you know, what's the point? I think I've answered that right.
In the
sense of the point isn't about the philosophical answers to the questions. The point is, how do we embody whatever practice in the world we find ourselves in? See, that's what I mean by effing the ineffable, is that ultimately spiritual practice, spiritual understanding, spiritual attainment has to be embodied in these human organisms, and that which we embody has to reach out to the rest of the creation. And how that happens and the quality of that process is, to me, the discrimination I would use to say to myself, to what degree is the absolute being effed here?
The effort of effing?
The effort of effing. Yeah.
Me?
Thank you.
I'm looking at the relationship between the general and the specific, and I like saying that love is like one of the most general of all emotions, that becomes the most specific when it's applied. So that the challenge in the moment is to love, and to ask, what does it mean to be loving in this moment or in that moment? And when we succeed in doing it, then suddenly there is this merging between the specific moment or the specific action with the general or the absolute. So it's about that the challenge of the merging in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the way I would gloss that, or is, first I'll say, just as a disclaimer, I tend to take the philosophical position, which again doesn't particularly matter, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I take the philosophical position that, you know, reality is found in the specific, and the general are abstractions thereupon. But I'm willing to be talked out of that one, so it doesn't particularly matter. But the point I want to make is that the embodying the, or effing the ineffable in this case, when we talk about something like we're all one, or we're all the same self, or something like that, I'm more interested, you know, it's an interesting concept, but I'm more interested in how one embodies that. How does one embody? Does one truly see others as themselves? Does one truly, at a heart level and a body level, treat others as though they are oneself? Does one actually experientially begin to lose the boundary between, you know, oneself and other, and see others as an act as though others are oneself, and you know, that's an open question. It's more like a koan for us to reflect upon.
It's asking that question,
right,
that makes the moment into the study that it needs to be,
right?
So that answers can be.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I guess I heard this years ago. I can't remember. I may have heard this from Lee Loswick again, quoting Daffrey John. When he was Daffrey John. I think this is a Daffrey John quote as opposed to a Thomas quote. But the quote was that it was kind of like a meditation question, a variation on neti neti that Daffrey John would recommend people to ask, and that is avoiding relationship. So, you know, in any given moment, you can ask yourself, am I avoiding relationship? It's a useful thing to ask, because it puts the onus on us to, you know, test ourselves, because if we truly are one, if we truly are merged with the absolute, there, you would expect there to be no compulsive avoiding of relationship. So to the extent that there is, there's probably something to look at. Or, yeah.
You know, I was actually thinking that same thing. you know, there's this idea of recognizing how you do merge or the dissolving of boundaries. You know, my sense is that the one who wants to do all that can't. You know, it doesn't come with the territory of the one who actually is the ego. You know, the ego doesn't want to be the ego, right? And so I think it's just much easier and much more practical to see how you don't merge, how you do feel separate.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, you feel the contraction, because I think that is one way to actually implement the observational quality that you were doing earlier, is to notice, well, how do I feel separate? How do I feel like I want to dominate and not be dominated? You know, all the things that define you as an ego.
Right.
Of course, at first, the basis of that is you have to be willing to say, I am an ego, not I have an ego. You know, because usually what I find is everybody that says, I have an ego, and I don't like my ego, or I want to expand my ego, well, who's saying that? Mm-hmm. It seems totally clear to me that's the ego.
Right. So in a sense, I would agree with what you're saying, that, you know, the challenge for you is it your ego saying it?
Yeah, I recognize myself as an ego and just...
As an identity, perhaps.
To look at myself in the way that I appear to be limited.
Well, okay, but the question, I guess what I'm not getting from that is that if... It's sort of a tricky area, because if you allow that limit and accept that limit, which is not a bad thing to accept, at the same time it may preclude the fact that there's something beyond that as well.
Well, what's beyond that is an idea. In other words, the actuality of it. When you're sitting there as an ego, there's the idea that there's an expansion beyond yourself as an ego. But in fact, it turns out to be an idea.
Well, I agree with what you're saying in the sense that if you have an idea that there's something beyond it, that's that could be an identification with an idea. On the other hand, if you the recognition or the intuition that there's something beyond that can also provide a source of purpose for why even engage in this in the first place. And that doesn't have to be conceptual. I mean, then I'm just, it doesn't have to be, it's not one or the other. It doesn't have to be that if I open myself up to the possibility of something larger than my egoic structure, that necessarily is a concept. I would agree 100% that lots of people, and I put myself in the same category, you know, before I got involved in a spiritual practice, I was very interested in, you know, occultism, because I was interested in, you know, great powers and expanding my ego to enormous potentials. And, you know, people do that. But the other is that I find, I guess, in humility, and the spiritual humility is more of a willingness to lay down the egoic structure, the willingness to put it into service of something that's beyond it. And that intuition, you don't have to define what it is. In fact, I would recommend one not define what it is, but to maintain a energetic connection with that through the level of intuition. And by that, that's code word for just non-conceptual connection. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that, that allows a certain something that is not to be defined to inform the cultivation of the presence that gives you the power or the context within which to lay down the egoic structure. So that's the additional gloss I would put on that.
Yeah. I don't think you have to disown your ego. I think you have to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an inner observer that recognizes when you're misusing your ego. I mean, I think you can control it, but I don't think you shouldn't feel that you want to abolish it.
I agree with that. I mean, and I hope nothing I've said here implies that
nothing
abolishing the ego, laying it down is different than, because the ego the egoic structure, what we call in our tradition the android, is a can be used consciously or unconsciously. When it's used compulsively, which is the state that most people find in this state of complete identification, then the human condition becomes one of mechanical reactions to external events. You know, we are constantly in reaction to the things that happen to us, however subtly and however sophisticated that reactivity may be. But we need, because of the world we live in, the social world we live in, the egoic structure contains information that's necessary for the navigating and the understanding and negotiation of that world. So in practice, laying down the egoic structure doesn't mean becoming a psycho case or becoming someone that you know, has to be put into a room somewhere.
The identity of everyone else.
It doesn't. In fact, when that happens, that's actually kind of a problem, and it's not. It doesn't actually give rise to the conditions that are conducive for responsible engagement in spiritual work. Responsible engagement in spiritual work means taking responsibility for the operation of this egoic structure and ultimately demonstrating or being able to inspire oneself to act from something within oneself rather than from external factors. Yeah.
I was actually going to make the same point in favor of the ego or say something about the ego. And it goes back to when this gentleman was talking about, he had the question about why spiritual groups don't study the self more. And I thought of Ospensky's idea that there's levels of consciousness. And he says that most spiritual groups, or whatever you want to call them, leave out the stage of self-consciousness. They want to go to cosmic consciousness with that, and skip that stage of self-consciousness, which is where the ego is, and the ego does have a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I almost would say that people who are only influenced by television and current fashion or whatever almost don't have an ego sometimes, or it's such a an individualized ego that they would need to build up some inner content before they were prepared to go to some other level.
Yeah, I think we're getting into kind of a semantic problem here.
Yeah.
Because just to clarify the discussion, that in the course of embodying spiritual practice, in our tradition and in the Fourth Way tradition, there is the notion of harmonizing the centers, which means that my intellectual center has a certain way of processing information. My emotional center has a way of processing information. My body center has a way of processing information. And when I live in a state of identification, the circuits are all jumbled around, and there's unconscious connections between all of these things, and energy is just sort of moving in uncontrolled ways. So when we practice and engage at a three-centered level in long-term practice, the intent is to awaken the centers such that they can function. They will still have the unique character that is a product of our individual experiences, but the functioning will then be able to be guided by something within us that is intentional as opposed to something that is accidental. And so in that sense, to call that the ego in the same way that we were calling the earlier thing the ego is actually confusing, because
right. It
is egoic in the sense that there is still room for an individual identity while we manifest in a body, even if we are merged with the absolute, if you will. But it's different from the compulsive, unconscious, egoic train wreck that most of us find ourselves in before we engage in spiritual practice.
Yes.
What does spiritual mean?
I don't know.
So what do you use the term if you don't know what it means?
Sells books.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm serious. It sells books. If I didn't say spiritual, half the people in this room wouldn't be here talking about this. And I don't mean that as a manipulative thing. It's simply an overly charged or inflated word that has very little content. But if it's sufficient to at least have any even 1% approximate tangential association with what I want to talk about tonight, then it's useful to use. So I said, put absolute. I don't like talking about the absolute. I really don't. I find it embarrassing.
It's fashionable these days to say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. What does that mean?
That I like to be fashionable.
But people really, you know.
No, I understand. Yeah,
yeah. Good answer, mate. But I'm like, seriously, like people say, oh no, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual.
I know.
What is that? What are they talking about? Is spiritual something supernatural, or is it just something non-physical? What does spiritual mean?
I guess the way I would say is my understanding of that to beyond just the fashionable statement, which I think is probably truer than we might admit when people say that, is that we're built. Now, we may be conditioned for this. This is actually an open question, which a foundation of practice gives you the tools to ask. But the question is, or the assertion is, we may be built to process or recognize qualities of energies that go beyond what is normally available in our waking consciousness, and that at an intuitive level there's an aspiration towards contact with that kind of energy. However, the vehicles for that in ordinary society have crystallized to the point that what originally were intended to be containers for that kind of experience, which were religions, have become sort of these disastrous sort of social control mechanisms that do probably crush what we might call a spirit in someone rather than to offer expansion of that. So people, in recognizing that, feel like they want to still recognize in their lives something higher than the ordinary conventional psychological life, but they also recognize at the same time that the traditional exponents of that kind of understanding have betrayed them. And therefore, they're uncomfortable identifying with a religion, but they still want to leave room in their lives for something beyond their psychological existence.
I see.
And so in that sense, because I confess I've probably even said that. I hope I haven't, but I probably have at some point in my life. Or, you know, if you're doing like a Facebook profile, what do you put when it says religion? You know? You say, well, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious, you know?
Fashionable.
Yeah, fashionable. And also the term religious now, you know, in this society, what do you see? You know, you see fundamentalists banging the Bible. Yeah, that's a very strong, you know.
Right, that's why people don't want to be associated.
Yeah, but people still want to leave room for something else.
Right.
And that's why I think people usually say it. But
it gives license for those sort of all-encompassing terms that you were talking about.
Yeah. As well, the problem is that the minute you say that, then we all pretend, so we can get along together in Sebastopol, that I mean the same thing by spiritual as you mean the same thing by spiritual. And we have a bookstore that has,
hard to get along in Sebastopol.
It's, actually, it depends.
Unless you want to put Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you like Wi-Fi? Do you want a building taller than two stories in the, in the commercial sector?
Let's pray about it.
So the point... Obviously, the point I'm making is that, you know, I agree with you. When the minute you say spiritual, and then we all sort of say, hey, we're all spiritual, and we all pretend to be spiritual together, it's great to sell books. And, you know, that's necessary to kind of, like, keep situations like this supported. But don't have any pretension that what you mean by spiritual is the same thing I mean by spiritual until we've worked together for a few years on what that means. And that's why I say that my standards of what constitutes spiritual, you know, I have fairly high standards in terms of whether someone is willing to engage in a high energy process of restructuring, if you will, or dissolution of the ego, or let us say to harmonizing of the three centers. If one is willing to do that, and that is more important than holding on to their pride, you know, then I'm willing to start to confer the term spiritual. But if they're not, then, if I can infer the term spiritual, it's more for social lubrication than anything else.
Social lubrication.
Yeah. I'm being honest here, because I mean, I affect a nice personality. And so my nice personality will, you know, in social situations, not want to make people wrong. You know, particularly when they come to the store, they're guests, you know, and I have to be a good host. And so it's my obligation as a host to be willing to meet people where they're coming from. But that doesn't mean that deep down, I'm being honest to you all now, because this is a small crowd, who most of whom have heard me talk before, deep down, I have a very high standard for what I mean by the term spiritual. And not very many people meet that standard.
Absolute means one. Why do we...
No, it doesn't.
Absolutely only one.
You're both wrong.
Absolutely not.
Absolute means vodka. I should have worn my vodka t-shirt. That would have been more important, because then but yeah, the Stolichnaya t-shirt, unfortunately, not an absolute t-shirt.
Absolute can't mean anything.
Yes, it can.
You're right. Now, what do you do with that?
Right. Sell some books.
So there is we're just going to let it be a free-for-all then. There is no definition to absolute. This is what I'll take home tonight. There doesn't mean one, and we got two.
Sweet dreams.
Right. Oh my God. There's absolutely no tea. Okay. Yeah. So
it's absolutely
this is probably a good time to break. But let me make a few concluding comments. So we engage in practical work on this subject matter in a couple of different forms. We have a study group that meets here on Tuesday evenings,
except for the fourth Tuesday.
Yeah. So it won't meet next Tuesday. So. But it will meet the following Tuesday. What's the name of the study group again?
Soul of Presence.
Soul of Presence. Its first incarnation was Dude, Where's My Soul? The next year it was Soul Without Measure, and now we're up to Soul of Presence. Okay. And but it's a context in which we talk more practically about these ideas and engage in some exercises, but mainly for people who are engaging in these exercises, we talk about what's coming up in their work. We have workshops we do periodically on, in particular, co-meditation, which is a two-person meditation, which is a form of self-observation that's intended to, in particular, work on the emotional center and relational issues. We have a workshop this Saturday on that, starting at 10 o'clock at our center in South Sebastopol, which is available. And if you're interested, there's you can see either Rob or Daniel or Amba about information on that. We have some regular Sunday meditations twice a month, and I think the next one is this Sunday, where we actually engage practically in the self-observation practice, and so there's some instruction there. And we do events like this. So, did I miss anything?
Yeah, there are books to buy.
There are books to buy here, some of which are from E.J. Gold, who are the founder of Taiyi Meditation Center. Robert Innes worked with E.J. Gold at one point in his spiritual training. So we maintain good relations with E.J.'s community. We have some Fourth Way books. We have The Way of Taiyu, which is a distillation of much of what we've talked about, written by our teacher, Robert Innes. And that's a nice guide, and there's actually even some exercises in there, but don't try them at home.
And we have a donation bowl over there to help support these events and
right.
support the work of
right.
the speaker.
So then the donation bowl is an opportunity for you to embody the absolute and to demonstrate that we are all one. That will help, literally help.
And that
keep
your
the,
wallet is one with ours.
But it helps,
spiritual way.
It helps keep the space available here. I mean,
Thank you.
The nice thing about this space is it we have constructed it to be a vessel for many different traditions. As I said, we're good hosts, so even if we don't necessarily agree with some of the people who do presentations here, we make the space available because we think that that ongoing dialogue is in the end beneficial. But the space itself is intended to be a container, and a container for discussions like we had this evening. So I thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you all for coming out. We look forward to seeing you at the next.